The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop, looking out over London.
Good night, and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening. This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Trump gave Jeff Sessions a sock and set him free.
Breaking news out of Washington today. Just moments ago, Attorney General Jeff Sessions resigning at the request of President Trump.
He wanted to leave to spend more time doing what he loves most, racism. Gosh, things are happening so fast today. Jeff Sessions has already packed up all his things into a thimble and hitched a ride on a bluebird back to the statue of Jefferson Davis where he makes his nest. Rod Rosenstein was also pushed aside today, and Trump's already updating the firmware of Melania's replacement. You know, it's no surprise that there are big personnel changes today. I don't know if you remember, but an election happened yesterday, and the House of Representatives is feeling a little blue.
That the Democrats now control the House is really an earthquake, a political earthquake, an investigative earthquake, and the first time that Donald Trump as president will be accountable to anybody.
Yes! Who needs a wave when you can have an earthquake? I wonder how Donald Trump feels about it. Mostly confused.
So if the Republicans won, and let's say we held on by two or one, or three. We win by one or two or three. And you'll have one or two or three or four or five even, but it looks like three. Could be four. Perhaps it could be two.
I haven't seen Trump struggle with math this much since somebody asked him how many kids he has. Actually, the complicated algorithm he was trying to work out was how many Senate seats the Republican Party gained yesterday in the midterms. Trump appeared at a rare press conference to explain why losing the House was actually good.
It really could be a beautiful bipartisan type of situation.
Right.
They can look at us, and then we can look at them, and it'll go back and forth, and it'll probably be very good for me politically. And with that, I'll take a few questions if you'd like. Whoa. I didn't know what happened. All right, go ahead, John. That was a lot of hand shooting up so quickly.
Oh, I have a question. What happened when he called on Jim Acosta?
Peter, listen, if I may ask, on the Russia investigation, are you concerned that you may have...
I'm not concerned about anything with the Russian investigation because it's a hoax. That's enough. Put down the mic.
Mr. President, are you worried about indictments coming down in this investigation? Mr. President...
I'll tell you what, CNN should be ashamed of itself having you working for them.
No, we should be ashamed of you working for us. Oh, my God.
Damn straight.
You are at work. This is behavior that would have gotten me fired from Tim Hortons. And they didn't even fire me for turning their donuts into bongs. It does not work. You get too high. That press conference was upsetting to watch, but not as upsetting as it was for this woman.
If I may ask
Peter,
one other question, are you worried?
That's enough. That's enough.
Mr. President,
I was
going to ask one of the other folks.
That's
had,
enough.
Pardon me, ma'am.
That's enough.
Mr. President,
I hate this job so much. Oh, my God. Why am I doing this? This is horrible. And plie.
All right, there's Sam B. From the morning after. I would have played that yesterday, except yesterday I had to play Cheryl Wheeler's If It Was Up to Me because we had another mass shooting. Oh, welcome to America. I am Nicole Sandler. Actually, welcome to a Friday. I don't know about you, but I am ready for this week to be over. It had its ups, it had its downs, it had its moments of insanity. Yesterday, did you get out to one of the rallies, one of the protests that was called to protect Mueller. David and I went to the one in Fort Lauderdale. You know, I got to say, Florida is so apathetic. That said, there were probably 200 to 300 people there, which is not for South Florida. That's a really good turnout. But as we looked around, we noticed that we were, you know, we weren't the oldest people there. We might have been some of the younger people there. Really, there were no young people there. It was an older white crowd, which was kind of disheartening. As we were leaving, and we didn't stay that long, as we were leaving, a young couple was coming up, and David told them that collectively the two of them would lower the median age of the crowd there, that they were needed. I don't know what it is with, I think it's a Florida thing, because if you looked around the country, oh my goodness, the protests were massive. Times Square, I shouldn't say Times Square, I should say New York City, because the crowd went on for a number of city blocks, and they marched from Times Square down to Union Square. They know how to do it in New York City. Florida is still Florida, and I guess I should be thankful that people did show up and that there was, you know, a decent showing of force. And then we were just on the street in front of the federal courthouse in Fort Lauderdale, which is where anytime there's a protest in Broward County, that's where it is. Again, Broward County is huge. This is where all the election problems are happening. Yeah, we'll get into that a little later. Somebody who's anonymous in the chat room actually made a good point. He said they called it for 5 p.m. Young people were working. They should have called it after working hours. And I do understand that. And we left a little bit after 6, and that's when those young people showed up. And so hopefully they were out there for a while. One thing that was encouraging, there was only a couple of assholes who, you know, when they drove by, they Trump, Trump. There were a lot of people driving by and honking their horns and waving and giving thumbs up and all that. I know we're going to have to do a whole lot more than that. A conversation I was having with someone, you know, was one protest is not anything. We need to do this all the time. We need to get out there and be heard. Well, hopefully, Floridians are being heard today as the recounts are going to happen. But before they can recount anything, they've got to first count the ballots. Somebody pointed out on Twitter, I can't remember who it was, that the Republicans are not just protesting the counting, the recount, they're protesting the counting in the first place. And of course, Donald Trump is out there claiming that that the election is going to be stolen, he and Marco Rubio. These people wouldn't know election fairness if it bit them on the ass. If it could, I don't think it can, you know. Let me think. What else? I know what I wanted to talk about. So Donald Trump, this morning, he's on his way to France, to Paris, and I'll explain what that's all about in What's News in a few minutes. So before he got on Marine One to get to Air Force One to fly off to France for the weekend, thank you very much, spoke to reporters outside the White House yet again, and he was asked about Jim Acosta, and if he's going to be getting his press credentials back. And Donald Trump just can't resist going after the press. So, but what he did this morning and yesterday in the press conference, you'll hear a pattern here that's quite disturbing. This is this morning.
I think Jim Acosta is a very unprofessional man.
So are you.
He does this with everybody. He gets paid to do that. You know, he gets paid to burst in. He's a very unprofessional guy. Whether it was me or Ronald Reagan or anybody else, he would have done the same thing. Look, I don't think he's a smart person, but he's got a loud voice. Wait, David, do you mind if I answer the question? And as far as I'm concerned, I haven't made that decision. But it could be others also.
Ah.
When you're in the White House, this is a very sacred place to me. This is a very special place. You have to treat the White House with respect.
Really?
You have to treat the presidency with respect. If you've ever seen him dealing with Sarah Huckabee Sanders, it's a disgrace. And he does it for you know, the reason. The same thing with April Ryan.
Ah, here goes after April Ryan.
I mean, you talk about somebody that's a loser.
A loser?
She doesn't know what the hell she's doing.
Oh, my God.
She gets publicity, and then she gets a pay raise, or she gets a contract with, I think, CNN. But she's very nasty, and she shouldn't be.
Wow. Wow.
You've got to treat the White House and the Office of the Presidency with respect.
By God, talk about opposite world. Maybe he should take his own advice. Treat the White House and the presidency with respect. He does neither. But so he went after Jim Acosta, which he's been doing. And in fact, there was even some speculation, informed speculation from what I understand, that that was planned out. That Trump and probably Huckabee's and a few other people planned this, that he was going to pick a fight with Jim Acosta as a way to get the heat off of, you know, the recounts, the election, the Whitaker bullshit. So I have no doubt that that was set up, completely set up. Otherwise, why would he even call on Jim Acosta, right? But so then he goes after April Ryan, a black woman who's a reporter for American Urban Radio Networks and is a CNN contributor, right? So, and also this morning at this little press gaggle before he got on the helicopter, he takes a question from Abby Phillips, also of CNN, another black woman. And what do you think? He goes after her too.
It's up to him.
So Abby Phillips asked, do you want Whitaker to rein in Mueller on the Russia probe? It's hard to hear her, but that's the question she asked.
It's up to him.
Do you want him to rein in Robert Mueller?
Do you want him to rein in Robert Mueller?
What a stupid question that is.
Oh, my
what
God.
A stupid
no, it really isn't.
But I watch you a lot. You ask a lot of stupid questions.
Oh, my God. And he says, I watch you. You ask a lot of stupid questions. Another black woman. Let me take you back to yesterday, to that weird, creepy press conference. And Yamiche Alcindor of the PBS NewsHour stood up and asked a question. And, well, just take a guess on how Trump treated her.
Mr. President, Yamiche Alcindor with PBS NewsHour. On the campaign trail, you called yourself a nationalist. Some people saw that as emboldening white nationalists. Now people are also saying
that the president... It's such a racist question.
There are some people
it's a racist
that
question?
The Republican Party is seen as supporting white nationalists because of your rhetoric. What do you make of that?
I don't believe it. I don't know. Why do I have my highest poll numbers ever African Americans? Why do I have among the highest poll numbers with African Americans?
Don't know. Well, you don't have.
Do I have my highest poll numbers? That's such a racist question. Honestly... I mean, I know you have it written down and you're going to tell me. Let me tell you, it's a racist question.
No, it isn't a racist question.
You know what the word is? I love our country.
Oh, God.
I do. You have nationalists, you have globalists. I also love the world. And I don't mind helping the world, but we have to straighten out our country first. We have a lot of problems.
And he's the biggest one.
But to say that, what you said, is so insulting to me. It's a very terrible thing that you said.
And Mr. President.
Yeah. So in two press events in a row, Donald Trump goes after probably three of the only African-American women in the White House press corps. It's not like there is lots of them. And he goes after each and every one of them. Gee, I wonder what they all have in common. The treatment of the press by this president is frightening. You know, I open the show each day with a produced open from our pal Boca Brittany about that a free press is necessary to a democracy. Well, you know, there's a reason I hone in on this topic a lot. It's one we'll talk about a little later this hour with Greg Sargent of The Washington Post. He writes the Plum Line blog for The Washington Post, one of my must-stop reads each morning. He's got a new book out. It's called An Uncivil War, Taking Back Our Democracy in an Age of Trumpian Disinformation and Thunderdome Politics. And so we're going to talk to Greg Sargent today on the show. But before we get to there... And to him, it's time for What's News.
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Well, you know this. Less than 24 hours after the midterm polls closed, Donald Trump fired Attorney General Jeff Sessions and named Sessions' Chief of Staff Matthew Whitaker as acting Attorney General, triggering a growing sense of concern both inside the White House and out.
Before Matt Whitaker became the Chief of Staff for Jeff Sessions a year ago, he was a conservative commentator. He said Special Counsel Robert Mueller's team should not cross some red lines.
It would be a fishing expedition if they start looking into essentially all of Trump's finances.
And Whitaker said a year and a half ago that he hadn't seen any proof of Russian collusion with the Trump campaign.
The truth is, there was no collusion
with
the Russians and the Trump campaign.
Right.
There was interference by the Russians into the election, but that is not the collusion with the campaign.
Some in Congress say those comments make him unqualified to oversee the Russia investigation.
We know he was chosen for the wrong reasons because of his views on the Russia probe.
But even some who question the appointment say Whitaker may see it differently now.
Bob Mueller is going to come in and brief him on the details of the investigation. And that, you are in a different place at that point.
And today, the husband of White House advisor Kellyanne Conway, George Conway, co-writes a column with former Solicitor General Neil Kochel, saying under the Constitution, the president can't make just anyone acting attorney general.
Principal officers, like heads of departments, have to be Senate confirmed. And our founders put that in for a reason, because you don't want the president's lackey to be serving in such an important role.
Duh.
Justice Department ethics lawyers will now advise Whitaker on whether he should recuse from the Russia investigation, but there's no sign that he intends to.
No.
Pete Williams, NBC News, Washington.
None whatsoever. But the president's action triggered a rapid response. Long-planned protests nationwide to protect Mueller.
Protesters say they're upset President Trump fired Jeff Sessions, and now wonder what it will mean for the Robert Mueller investigation into Russian collusion in the Trump campaign. Tonight, dozens of protesters are gathering at Town Center in Virginia Beach.
They're occurring as a way of expressing our concern about the actions President Trump took yesterday.
Ron Rowe is a member of Indivisible 757, a left-wing group that's been standing by to call for a protest if something like this happened.
People are outraged. We've been expecting this for quite some time. The organizations that have planned these rallies planned them over a year ago.
Sessions' firing ends months of speculations about how long he would stay on the job. President Trump has been very critical of him for recusing himself during the Russian investigation.
He should have never recused himself.
And now Sessions' chief of staff will be acting attorney general. He's been critical of the investigation in the past and will now oversee it.
Has the president instructed him to limit the investigation?
No, the president
in any
hasn't
way?
Instructed him to do anything other than be the acting attorney general.
But the protesters say they're following along closely, and with hundreds of similar rallies going on around the country, say they hope the president gets their message.
Tonight is not the end of the message. Tonight is the beginning of the message. The groups will be doing many things after tonight to make sure that that message gets to the president.
President Trump has said he will let the Mueller investigation continue, but says he can stop it.
Yeah.
In Virginia Beach, Brendan Ponton, News 3.
Yeah, he said he can stop it anytime. He can fire anyone he wants. There were over 900 protests held last night, at least one in every state. Stay tuned for more. In Thousand Oaks, California, hundreds of people gathered for a vigil last night as a mother deals with the senseless loss of her son.
My son was in Las Vegas with a lot of his friends, and he came home. He didn't come home last night, and I don't want prayers. I don't want thoughts. I want gun control, and I hope to God nobody else sends me any more prayers. I want gun control. No more guns.
I fully understand. As Thousand Oaks grapples with the latest of America's mass shootings, another tragedy is unfolding. Evacuations were ordered as strong Santa Ana winds fanned a new wildfire just a few miles from that shooting site.
Two fast-moving wildfires devastating parts of California right now. More than 20 million people under red flag warnings across the state, meaning conditions are ideal for rapid spreading. The campfires already consumed over 20,000 acres in Butte County, a fire NATO doing some of the destruction. At one point on Thursday, the campfire grew at the rate of a football field every 3 seconds. As many as 1,000 buildings have been charred. The fire now spreading into Chico, the biggest city in Butte County, with 100,000 people.
Meantime, California's acting governor declaring a fire emergency. About 40,000 residents
have been evacuated, and that includes all the patients who are at the Adventist Health at Feather River Hospital. One family got in the car to evacuate, drove through the flames to escape, and literally were praying for their lives. Listen to this.
I hope mom's going to be all right. God, it's so hot.
I know, baby. Hold on. Can't see.
It'll be all right. We'll be okay.
Oh, Lord Jesus.
It's just chilling what they have to go through to get out of there. Fire officials report civilians and at least two firefighters have been injured. Authorities are waiting for safer conditions to assess the damage.
And in Ventura County, the Hill Fire burning between 5 and 7,000 acres so far. Officials expect the fire to reach all the way to the Pacific Ocean. Mm. The 101 freeway remains closed in both directions. Wow. Some drivers went straight into that cloud of smoke. This is the same county, of course, as last night's shooting at the Borderline Bar and Grill. Approximately 1,200 homes are under mandatory evacuation. And nearby 30,000 people also now evacuated in Ventura and Los Angeles counties due to the Woolsey Fire. 7,500 acres already destroyed. The fire has now entered into L.A. County.
Yes, and in fact, Malibu, the entire city of Malibu, is being evacuated this morning. Last night, Thousand Oaks was evacuated. You know, our friend Got a Laugh lives in Thousand Oaks, just a few miles away from the bar where the shooting took place the night before. They were evacuated at 3 o'clock in the morning. So Laffy, you can find her on Twitter, at Got a Laugh. The family's fine. She and the dog and the cats and the husband all went to their son's house, apartment in Burbank, where they're just waiting for word. They have no idea what's happening to their home. We just keep putting out good thoughts, right? The 2018 midterm election votes are still being counted in many places, including California, Arizona, and of course, Florida. Here in Florida, Governor Rick Scott, the GOP candidate in the Senate race, accused Democrats of trying to steal the election. Democratic Senator Bill Nelson, Scott's opponent, said the governor's actions appear to be politically motivated. You think? Now, most of the ballots that are still being counted are right here in Broward County. Here's how the local ABC affiliate covered the story yesterday afternoon.
Days after the midterm election, and workers in Broward are still counting votes. So what's the holdup? Local 10 News investigator Jeff Weinzier went straight to the supervisor to get some answers. Jeff.
Calvin, we've been here all day long. We have not been able to get a concrete answer to that question. What we can tell you is, once again, all eyes are on Broward.
Broward County.
Other counties managed to get it done, many on election night. But as we speak, behind this door right here, ballots are still being counted. 42 hours after the polls closed, just after 1 o'clock this afternoon, three carts full of mail-in ballots are finally wheeled into the tabulation room.
The final. No more vote by mail ballots.
This is Brenda Snipes, the supervisor of elections. You got to listen to this woman. She's a moron.
7 o'clock on Tuesday night. It is now Thursday. Mm-hmm. We are still counting ballots in Broward County.
5 pages or 6 pages for each of the people who voted.
But other counties have been able to do it.
Yep.
But other counties didn't have 600,000.
Quit making excuses.
Well, have you been inside my... Never mind. Let me go check. I'll check.
But it's a serious issue. It always seems like...
Let me go check.
It's a serious issue with me. I've been doing this now since October 22nd.
But if it's a serious issue with you...
We ran 22 sites. We ran 14 days. We ran 12 hours. We had a big vote by mail. So don't try to turn it around to make it seem like I'm making comedy out of this.
I don't think anybody's making. But the question, but there are serious questions.
Sometimes it takes a little extra time to make sure that we get the outcome that the voters intended.
Outside the canvassing board room, there was a line of voters who say they mailed in their ballots, but...
Online, it's not showing that my vote is counted. It's
Deanna Christensen says she was told it could take up to 3 days for her vote to appear online. Are you leaving here feeling satisfied?
No, not at all.
This is really important for us. This is really important for all of us.
Again, behind the doors, there are eight machines. They're using about four of them right now. Those mail-in ballots still being counted. In another room not far from here, the canvassing board is going over 205 provisional ballots. We are told by the supervisor of elections here that no deadlines will be missed.
Right.
We're live in Lauderhill. Jeff Wines here. Local 10 News.
All right. So that was yesterday. Today, this morning, there are reports that a MAGA crowd of around 60 people or so is now surrounding the location where the votes are being counted and chanting, "Lock her up." That's in reference to Supervisor of Elections Brenda Snipes, who I think most Democrats would agree she sucks at her job. Get her the hell out of there. They're also chanting Gillum is a criminal, which he most assuredly is not. Someone in the chat room just asked, Snipes is a Republican, right? Bush appointed? I don't know what party she is, but she was appointed by a Republican. Yeah, I believe Jeb Bush appointed her. By the way, I've been checking to see if my ballot, it says it was received. It doesn't say it was tabulated, which I guess they don't say that they've been tabulated until after the final numbers are in. Again, it's Florida. Meanwhile, in Arizona's Senate race, Democrat Kyrsten Sinema has moved into a slight lead over Republican Martha McSally. There are still around 500,000 votes left to count. Construction on the Keystone XL pipeline has been stopped. A federal judge halted work on the pipeline after ruling that the U.S. government's use of a 2014 environmental review to justify issuing a presidential permit for construction violated the National Environmental Policy Act, the Endangered Species Act, and the Administrative Procedure Act. So no more work on the pipeline can proceed until the government does an additional review of the pipeline's potential impact on the environment. Environmentalists and Native American groups have fought the pipeline for years, but Trump okayed a permit to start its construction right after he took office last year. Oh, well, sorry. What did he say? Sorry, Mike. Yeah, sorry, Donald. Donald Trump is now headed to Paris for the weekend. He's flying in for the centennial commemoration of the end of World War I. This is the lovely part. But he's going to skip the Paris Peace Forum hosted by French leader Emmanuel Macron. He'll reportedly hold a one-on-one with Macron and attend ceremonies and meals with other leaders, including Russian President Vladimir Putin. But he's going to leave before the global cooperation meeting organized by Macron as the focal point of the gathering. Trump declared in August that he would attend these ceremonies after he said Washington municipal authorities had given a ridiculously high cost for a military parade he wanted to stage in Washington on November 11th. The aim of the forum, by the way, is to avoid war by promoting global cooperation. The Trump administration yesterday unveiled new rules to sharply limit migrant asylum claims by barring individuals who cross the U.S. southern border illegally from seeking protections. CNN has more.
The Trump administration is slashing the number of refugees the U.S. will admit to a new record low. The cap for 2019 now set at 30,000 people. That's down from the previous record of 45,000. This current year, down from 110,000, nearly four times as much in 2017 during the Obama administration. CNN's senior international correspondent, Ara Demin, joins us now. You've met with the people most impacted by this policy. How are they reacting to this?
You know, it's absolutely heartbreaking because these are populations, whether you're talking about those that are stuck festering in refugee camps inside Syria, inside their own country, to those who are even here in Turkey or scattered throughout Europe, or even people that are trying to flee various different African nations and other parts of the world. These are among the most desperate of populations. And these are populations who really want to believe in this American dream, who really want to believe that America, at the very least, is going to be a country that lives up to its fundamental principles. And to see that the United States is doing the complete contrary, just turning its back on these populations. Look, we've had numerous conversations with people inside Syria who have been through things that we can't even begin to imagine, who keep saying, why does America turn away from us? And I think the thing that perhaps the administration does not necessarily realize is that turning your back on someone who is that desperate can potentially be much more dangerous than holding out a helping hand and trying to actually lift them out of their circumstances.
Right. But this is Donald Trump we're talking about. A new report in the Wall Street Journal has found that Donald Trump was involved in every step of the hush money payments to Karen McDougal and Stormy Daniels, contradicting months of denials and raising the possibility he broke campaign finance laws. The U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan has gathered evidence of Mr. Trump's participation in the transactions. And that's a good thing. Again, this is not in I just lost my train of thought. This is not in Robert Mueller's purview. This is the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan, and Trump can't, issue any pardons there. All right. Let's see. Oh, it's we're at the half hour mark, and it's you know what? Let's just get Greg Sargent on the line because he's expecting our call now. And, you know, he's been on the show with me before, but it's been a while. And so, I don't want to keep him holding when I call. So we'll just do it live. One ringy dingy. We're calling Greg Sargent, who writes the Plumline blog at The Washington
Hello.
Post. Hey, Greg, it's Nicole Sandler calling. How you doing
hey,
today?
How are you?
I'm hanging in there. How about you?
Good.
Okay. Well, I was telling the listeners that obviously you write the Plumline blog at the Washington Post. It's part of my every morning daily reading routine. You're also the author of the new book, An Uncivil War, Taking Back Our Democracy in an Age of Trumpian Disinformation and Thunderdome Politics. I understand the Trumpian disinformation part. What is Thunderdome Politics?
Ah, well, thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
So Thunderdome politics refers to two things, actually. The first is the kind of zero-sum death struggle that results in politics when all rules, norms, and basic standards of fair play go out the window.
Uh-huh.
And the second is the kind of crude politics as blood sport entertainment tenor that Trump has kind of dragged us all down to. So Thunderdome politics, in essence, is supposed to encapsulate both those things, and I hope it does a good job of kind of explaining or at least integrating all these different things into one term and capturing what it feels like these days.
Yeah, well, it feels like we're under siege. That's the sort of the feeling I got from the book. If there's an overall theme, it might be that democracy is under siege, but we must keep working at fixing things. Because there's no alternative. Is that fair to say?
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, it's sort of a constant. I mean, I talked to voting rights lawyers in the course of doing this book, and one thing that always I came away with is this exactly what you're talking about is this sense that every 2 seconds there's another assault on democracy to beat back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even when you've won, say a case. Defeating a particular effort to suppress the vote or gerrymander, there's just they come back with another rejiggered version of the same thing it's basically endless. And I think we're seeing a lot of this right now, right this minute, in fact, mm-hmm. in places like Georgia and Florida.
Yep. Well, you know, I'm here in Florida. This is sort of a broken record that I think we're just destined to relive, I guess, 2000. But things are getting uglier than they usually are down here. There's apparently a bunch of MAGA protesters out in front of the Broward Supervisor of Elections office this morning, chanting things like "Lock her up." Talking about Brenda Snipes, the supervisor of elections, who should be replaced by now, it's an ugly scene developing down there. You mentioned the notion of fair play in politics. Welcome to Florida. Politics seem to be getting dirtier by the day. Do you think there was ever a time when politicians here played fair?
Well, not really. I mean, I mean fair play in politics is really as an ideal more than anything else. I think we all know that that politics is always going to be dirty and vicious. But
mm-hmm.
but what I try to argue in the book is that even though it feels a lot of the time like there's a profound asymmetry in dirty tactics and hardball politics between Republicans and Democrats, basically, what Democrats and progressives have to stand for is trying to at least move us towards an ideal of fair play. And that it's a complicated equilibrium to reach because you're going to want to escalate in certain ways. Otherwise, you're unilaterally disarming. And so what I argue is that Democrats need to figure out a way to both not unilaterally disarm and escalate where it's appropriate and reasonable, but at the same time try to move our system where possible towards greater ideals of procedural fairness. And I think I hope I get the balance right. I think over time we'll have to see how that plays out, but my hope is that we can get the balance right with enough experimentation and diligence.
The problem is, I think, not so much the Democrats, although I may be a bit biased here, but, you know, I think we have to agree that Trump is a different animal than we've seen before. As bad as Republican policies have been, he seems to have escalated the dirty parts, the ugliness beyond certainly my imagination. I never thought the stuff that we're seeing now would be happening here. And the fact that he continues to attack the legitimacy of our elections seems to be in and of itself a danger to democracy. I know Trump famously said that something like along the lines, he'd accept the outcome of the 2016 election as long as he wins.
Right. I think that's a critical quote that people still don't talk about enough. Mm-hmm. And it really previews a lot of what we're seeing today. What he told his supporters was, if the election, if we don't win, we shouldn't accept the outcome. I mean, this is just to be as clear as possible, he said this publicly repeatedly.
Yeah.
to the half of the country that was preparing to vote for him.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes really counter to basic understandings of the transfer of power. And you know, it's hard to know what he would have done if he had lost, although I have a feeling we might find out in 2020. I wouldn't predict that, but we might.
Right.
And so, you know, we're seeing that right now today. I mean, look at Florida. He essentially said that if we count all the votes, that will be illegitimate.
Yeah.
I mean, he has said this.
He has.
And it's exactly the same thing, just reprised in a new way. And look, this is a lot worse than I think many Republicans have been historically. Republicans, of course, have done a lot of voter suppression, mm-hmm. and hideous partisan gerrymandering, and have played extreme hardball in all kinds of ways in legislative battles. But Trump is really, I think, taking a lot of this stuff to another level of explicitness, if you will.
Yeah.
Right? It's one thing to sort of push bogus voter fraud myths, which Republicans have done for a long time in order to justify voter suppression. It's another to say that the outcome won't be legitimate unless we win it.
Yeah. And that's my fear. And in fact, I've heard, I can't remember who it was. It was one of the hosts on MSNBC has also said that I think it's a man. He worries that, you know, if Trump does lose an election, say 2020, that he'll claim the election was rigged, would encourage his followers not to accept a peaceful transfer of power. And who knows what would ensue after that. That is a fear. Just what he's doing with Florida. This morning he tweeted out, as soon as Democrats sent their best election-stealing lawyer, Mark Elias, to Broward County, they miraculously started finding Democrat votes. Don't worry, Florida. I'm sending much better lawyers to expose the fraud. Fraud in all caps. I mean, this is dangerous.
To be clear, he is saying that the votes, that all the votes in Democratic areas shouldn't be counted. He went out and said something similar about Georgia today, where the gist of it was, you know, this is over.
Wow.
Right?
Yep.
Before the votes are counted. I mean, it's just an incredible thing for the president of the United States to do.
It's frightening. And he seems to not, you mentioned, you talk about the norms of our, you know, of life. He openly seems to reject them. He acts like the rules don't matter to him. And the lying is another, I guess is just more of the infection that's you know, hurting this country right now. His lying is unprecedented. Your paper, The Washington Post, has kept a running track of how many lies he engages in on a daily, weekly, and monthly basis, and it's ridiculous. I don't know how they can even keep track of it anymore. But apparently, during the elections, the numbers skyrocketed. He just makes stuff up as he goes along.
That's true. I believe our count of false and misleading statements is over 6,000 this president now.
Right. So,
it's really a remarkable thing. I mean, my one argument I make in the book is that for Trump, lying is really about power.
Mm-hmm.
And so one way to understand, everyone seems sort of baffled. To take a specific example, the White House just circulated a doctored video that was supposed to show that Jim Acosta of CNN manhandled the woman who tried to take the mic from
him. Right, the intern. And
Sarah Sanders flagrantly lied about what happened on Twitter, right? And that's the White House speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone was baffled. Like, how could they possibly lie about something that's out there on video? And you know, my argument is that it's precisely because the lies are so that the lies are so disprovable that they say them. It's like an assertion of power to say, it doesn't even matter if you can debunk this. It mm-hmm. doesn't even matter how many times you've debunked it. I'm still saying it.
Right.
That's the assertion of power.
It's the gaslighting of America, right? It's the gaslighting of America, where this has been from day one when Sean Spicer insisted that there were the biggest crowds ever for a presidential inauguration. I liken it to them telling us the sky is green. We know it's blue, but they tell us we're crazy because the sky is green. And after a while, you start to think, well, maybe I am crazy. Maybe the sky really is green because they keep saying it.
They want to wear us down. You know, there's a Sean Spicer moment that I still think should be talked about more, and I forget exactly when it was, but a good jobs report came out kind of early for the president, and Sean Spicer went before the press corps and said something like, the president wanted me to say this to you, because he knew that they were all going to be asking, well, you know, Trump said the jobs numbers were fake under Obama, so how can you be trumpeting them now,
uh-huh.
right? And he said, Trump, and I'm paraphrasing, this is not an exact quote, Sean Spicer said something like, Trump told me to tell you that the jobs numbers are real when they're good for us. And, right? And so, and everyone kind of laughed.
Right.
But, but they actually mean this. Like, that's the thing, right? It's not a joke for them. The whole point is to essentially say, as absurd as you think that sounds, we can say that. And our supporters will stick with us. It's an assertion of power.
Right. Well, along those lines of assertion of power, you also mentioned the notion that Trump's relentless lying is an extension of his authoritarian tendencies. I find his praise of authoritarian leaders like Putin and Kim Jong-un and Turkey's Erdogan and Duterte of the Philippines, I mean, it's frightening, but those are the people he's trying to sidle up next to while he picks fights with our allies. The worry about his authoritarian tendencies is real. I mean, just yesterday, he put out a new, I think it was an executive order, to limit the people applying for asylum in this country.
Yeah, I mean, I will say that I'm really glad that Democrats took back the House, in part because of what you just brought up. I'm really hopeful that on immigration in particular, we can really get some serious oversight, because the amount of bad faith and really nefarious motives that have gone into the construction of this administration's immigration agenda is just bottomless. And it's just passed without any kind of serious congressional scrutiny. And so, I mean, asylum is a really good example of it. I believe early on in the administration, the Times broke a story in which Stephen Miller had been caught essentially suppressing internal administration data showing that refugees were actually a net positive for the country.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, on front after front after front on immigration, take the Muslim ban, for instance, there were two Department of Homeland Security analyses which completely debunked their national security rationale for that. So they really just tried to put in place an ethno-nationalist agenda and really come up with all kinds of fake rationales for it. And the constant restrictions on asylum seeking is a really important component of that. And so I'm really hoping that a robust oversight agenda from House Democrats can expose what went into some of these policies.
I hope so, too. We're speaking with Greg Sargent. He writes the Plumline blog at The Washington Post, something you should check out every day. And he's the author of a brand new book called An Uncivil War, Taking Back Our Democracy in an Age of Trumpian Disinformation and Thunderdome Politics. So talking about all the things that are a threat to our democracy, we're seeing Republican voter suppression efforts escalating just when you think they can't, you know, do anything more. You know, we learn about interstate cross-check, and we learn about the exact match way to boot people off the voter rolls in Georgia, which I guess was just ruled unconstitutional by a judge in Georgia. All these voter suppression efforts, voter ID, which the ID is not the problem. It's the restrictions on what kind of an ID you can use. The fact that in Texas, you can use your gun license, but you can't use your college ID. These are tactics aimed at keeping down the vote for people who are prone to vote Democratic. Voter ID, cross-check, voter caging, all this has to have some impact on the numbers of Democrats voting, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, you're putting your finger on what is precisely problematic about this stuff. I mean, one could argue that you could construct a voter ID law in a way that's not disenfranchising.
Absolutely.
And in fact, in the book, I argue that, you know, maybe we should consider compromise offers to Republicans in which we'd exchange some form of voter ID, provided it's not at all disenfranchising, for a Republican agreement to make voting as easy as possible in many ways. And you could see compromises like that being developed. But as you say, the problematic aspect of this arises when the laws are deliberately constructed in order to make to target particular constituencies. And the way this is sometimes done is they will allow certain types of ID, which their own constituencies tend to have more often, and not allow other types of ID, which Democratic-leaning constituencies tend to have. That's where it gets problematic and really incredibly undemocratic and reprehensible.
Right. And what went on in North Dakota with the voters on the various Indian reservations, and they jumped through hoops to get new ID that had a house number, even though they don't have house numbers, they use P.O. boxes. And then when it came down to it, they wouldn't accept these new IDs either. I mean, obviously, these are aimed at keeping people from voting. Gerrymandering is another problem. I mean, a big problem. You note that both sides have done it, but since the Republicans took control of so many state legislatures after the 2010 midterms, they seem to have taken even that to a new extreme. Somehow the Democrats won enough votes to take back control of the House the other day. But they've won the popular vote before and still didn't get control in the past. So was it just that so many more people came out and voted this time that the Democrats were able to get a majority?
Yeah, I mean, I think it should be said that you can kind of breach these things. You can overcome these types of impediments to democracy with enough turnout. And that's another argument I make in the book, which is that we really want to try to do all we can to bring more and more people into the process. Look, the majority is going to end up, I believe, some of the projections are putting the Democratic win in the House popular vote at something like 7 points, And, you know, Nate Cohn had a terrific piece the other day in the Times in which he said, look, this is comparable to the Democratic victory in 06 and the Republican victory in 2010 in terms of the national popular vote. Yet Democrats are only going to end up with 35 or more seats, whereas Republicans won 63 in 2010.
Yeah.
What he argues there, and I think shows convincingly, is that it's the structural disadvantages like gerrymandering and the distribution of Democratic voters in an inefficient way that are limiting the total number of seats won relative to the popular vote win. It took a huge popular vote win to take back the House. But I think that what that illustrates is that these impediments actually do still have an impact because they're ending up with fewer seats than, say, Republicans did when they won in in 2010 by a similar margin.
Right. And I think, I mean, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I think that there were a couple of midterms during the Obama years when the Democrats actually did win the popular vote, but still lost control of the House.
I think there was just one
maybe
year.
Maybe one,
and,
yeah.
And it's tricky. It's a complicated debate. I mean, I think the last time it happened might have been the 1940s.
Oh, really?
I could be wrong about that. Yeah.
Okay.
But look, I mean, one thing that's worth saying is that it is a feature of our system that the national popular vote is not usually in line with the seat spread, but for all kinds of reasons. But the problem arises when that is partly the result of deliberate efforts to waste people's votes. That's what I argue against in the book, is the use of partisan gerrymandering to deliberately waste the opposition's votes.
Mm-hmm.
That, to me, is where it becomes problematic.
I agree. One of the most disconcerting things watching this White House is the way Trump attacks the media. Other presidents have had, you know, adversarial relationships with the press. That comes with the territory. That's the job of a press, is to hold the government accountable, to ask the questions. It's a cornerstone of democracy. Yet we saw the White House take away Jim Acosta's press pass, and Trump this morning warned that more could be coming. And then he attacked April Ryan. He attacked Abby Phillips, another African-American CNN reporter. And this comes after he went after Yamiche Alcindor at the press conference yesterday when he said her question was racist when she asked about him calling himself a nationalist and how that,
That's
you know.
Right.
Obviously, he's got a problem with women. I think he's got a problem with African-American women or women of color. But he really has a problem with the press. And again, this goes back to what we were talking about authoritarian regimes. There have been other countries that have, shut down the media and used Trump as their excuse to do it, calling out fake news.
I'll tell you one thing that really bothers me about, there's a couple things about what you just brought up that bother me. First, it's simply amazing that the president responded to the question about nationalism the way he did. Just,
mm-hmm.
just to remind everyone what happened. He was asked by a black reporter whether, when he said he was a nationalist, whether he was embracing white
nationalism.
You know what,
Greg? I've got the question here. Let me play it so people can hear exactly what happened. This was Yamiche Alcindor asking the question.
Yeah.
Ah, and now my. It won't play. I'm having here we go.
Mr. President, Yamiche Alcindor with PBS NewsHour. On the campaign trail, you called yourself a nationalist. Some people saw that as emboldening white nationalists. Now people are also saying
that
the president.
That's such a racist question.
There are some people that say that now the Republican Party is seen as supporting white nationalists because of your rhetoric. What do you make of that?
I don't believe it. I don't know. Why do I have my highest poll numbers ever with African Americans? Why do I have among the highest poll numbers with African Americans? I mean, why do I have my highest poll numbers? That's such a racist question. Honestly? I mean, I know you have it written down and you're going to tell me. Let me tell you, it's a racist question.
And Mr. President, I
love
ask...
You know what the word is? I love our country. I do. You have nationalists, you have globalists. I also love the world. And I don't mind helping the world, but we have to straighten out our country first. We have a lot of problems.
And
excuse me. But to say that, what you said, is so insulting to me. It's a very terrible thing that you said.
And Mr. President,
oh my God! I every time I hear that, I can't believe what I'm listening to.
I mean, just try to imagine. As we know already, that the Trump presidency has emboldened white nationalists and alt-right groups in a big way. So for Trump to field a question about white nationalism from a black reporter and then call the question racist is just such an unbelievable message to send to those groups. I guarantee you they take from that, you know, some really, really emboldening messages.
Mm-hmm. And the way he treats the media, I mean, threatening to take away more press passes this morning when he said he hadn't decided whether or not Jim Acosta was going to get his back. This is not how the relationship between the administration and the press is supposed to work in a democracy.
Well, it was good that Trump confirmed that the that the punishment of Acosta was actually about chilling other media scrutiny. That's what he inadvertently confirmed by saying, you know, that I'm thinking of taking away more.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So yeah. I think a lot of reporters will think to themselves, well, if I ask the president aggressive questions, I might lose my my privileges.
Yep.
Right. But I think one thing that just never quite gets enough attention about Trump's attacks on the media is that he does them even after they've incited violent intent. Right.
Yep.
So remember, Robert Chain was arrested after leaving threatening voicemails on Boston Globe employee voicemails.
Right.
And he, Robert Chain, alleged, who alleged, I should say that was alleged, he is alleged to have quoted Trump language in those voicemails. He said, "You're the enemy of the people, and then I'm going to kill you,"
yep.
and so forth and
yep.
so on. And so Trump knows this, right?
Right.
And he continues to use the language anyway, even though it was quoted by someone who allegedly threatened to murder reporters.
Right.
Now, the only conceivable conclusions you can reach from that are either that he doesn't care that his language might be inciting that type of violent intent or potential violence, or he's just perfectly fine if it does. I don't know what else you can conclude from.
I don't either. And someone was just arrested, I think, yesterday for making threatening threats to CNN. I mean, this is happening. The guy who sent out the bombs. I mean,
right, there were the bombs.
Yeah.
Five bombs, too. And
yeah.
and then there was an actual, of course, if you think about what happened in Pittsburgh,
yep.
11 people were murdered allegedly by a man who was quoted repeatedly ranting about how, you know, Jewish people are organizing or bringing in refugees to undermine real Americans.
Right.
He didn't use that language, but it was something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, this comes at a time when many Republicans and conservative media figures are pushing the Soros, the
yep.
conspiracy that Soros is manipulating the migrant caravan. And then after this happened, after Pittsburgh, after 11 people are killed by a guy essentially echoing these types of conspiracy theories, Trump is asked by reporters whether he thinks Soros is behind the caravan. And he plays it cute and says something like, "I don't know, you tell me, he
yeah.
could be, he might be."
Ugh.
This
Ugh.
Is after 11 people were killed.
Yeah. He doesn't understand how to act like a civilized human being. I mean, it's always something that's intended to inflame the national mood, it seems. It's dangerous. I mean,
yeah.
I keep going back to the word dangerous. Nancy Pelosi said she wants to work in a bipartisan way once the Democrats take control of the House in January. Now, a lot of Democrats that I know would prefer that the Dems play hardball to, as you put it, shift their general attitude toward political combat in every fundamental way. If they do that, I mean, are we on to more protecting the democracy, or is this just going to make things even worse?
Well, I don't take seriously what Pelosi said in that sense. I think, you know, we always hear politicians make noises about bipartisanship after they win elections,
uh-huh.
except from Trump.
Right.
But you know, I think we're going to have to see what she means by that. I'd be really surprised if they didn't really try right away to pass some serious pro-democracy reforms. I think they will. I think they'll try to do various voting access reforms and various anti-corruption measures really right out of the gate. And whether we see bipartisanship, I mean, you can kind of envision certain types of bipartisan compromises that I think we'd want to see, right?
Mm-hmm.
Especially on immigration.
Yeah.
I think, you know, there may be a temptation to deny Trump any kind of credit for anything or any kind of achievements, kind of the way Republicans tried to do to Obama.
Mm-hmm.
But if there are major humanitarian stakes here, I can't imagine that we would really argue that in that type of situation. I mean, if Democrats can reach a reasonable deal with Trump on protecting the Dreamers, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of young people
mm-hmm.
Who are trying to become part of this country. If they can somehow roll back a little bit of the cruelty towards asylum seekers and essentially take off the table any further family separation craziness, that type of stuff.
Yep.
It would be hard to argue that, depending on the circumstance, it'd be hard to argue that a deal like that shouldn't be
right.
made.
I hear you. Greg Sargent, the book is called An Uncivil War, Taking Back Our Democracy in an Age of Trumpian Disinformation and Thunderdome Politics. It's an easy read, it's worth the read, because this is about our future. Greg, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate your work.
Thanks very much. Always appreciate it.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that does it for us for today and for the week. Have a wonderful weekend, and I'll see you back here Tuesday.